It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Iowa Week all this week on IPR's talk shows, River to River, and our 10 o'clock show, Talk of Iowa, with Charity Nebbe. The theme this year, Unexpected Iowa. What aspects of our state are unique and surprising? And what's the story behind how they became part of Iowa's identity? Well, certainly, if I ask the question, what's something unexpected about Iowa that has become central to our state's identity? You would have to say the Iowa caucuses is a very good answer. The Iowa caucuses are known around the nation, around the world, in our electoral process. Why Iowa, though? How did that happen? How have the Iowa caucuses shaped our campaign politics? And what have been some of the criticisms of Iowa's first-in-the-nation status? So those are just some of the questions we'll be tackling this hour with our three guests. Donna Hoffman is with us, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa and a scholar of presidential politics. Donna Hoffman in our Cedar Falls studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Also with us, Caroline Tolbert is a political science professor at the University of Iowa, co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. Caroline, welcome back to our studio in Iowa City.
Thank you.
David Yepsen joins us by phone, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, former political writer at the Des Moines Register, long history of reporting on and writing about politics of Iowa as a columnist. David Yepsen, welcome back to our program.
It's good to be with you.
And this hour, we're going to be reaching out to you, our listeners. What are your questions about the workings of the Iowa caucuses? Perhaps you have a personal caucus experience that stands out in your memory. We'd like to have you share that this hour. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. 1-866-780-9100. Or tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to give us your personal caucus experience that stands out in your memory. David Yepsen, let's start with this question at the front end of our discussion. Why Iowa? How did it get to this position? Can you tell us that story?
Well, Iowa's important because Iowa's first. It's the first big early test of presidential candidate strength. And that's, you know, it begins the presidential selection process. It actually goes back. It started in its significance started as a result of the Vietnam War and the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, which turned into a riot. The Democratic Party decided it wanted to open itself up to more debate and discussion and be more inclusive, and so they created a system of caucuses, of local conventions, all designed to let activists participate. Well, in order to do that in Iowa, you have a national convention in, say, August. You have to have a state convention in June. You have to have district conventions in May. You have to have county conventions in February or March. And as they tried to space this thing out, they wound up shoving these caucuses on into February of 1972. In fact, one story is that they figured out how much time they needed between events by how fast an old Gestetner mimeograph machine at the Democratic State Central Committee could run thousands of notices. And they timed it, and the story is, and I think there's some truth to it, that's how they came up with this space between these events. But the fact is, we started the selection process early in 1972, and a few reporters came to Iowa and covered George McGovern's challenge of Ed Muskie in that contest. McGovern, on the strength of a good showing by anti-war activists, as well as some really lousy weather that kept a lot of party moderates and regulars and Muskie people at home, McGovern had one of those surprise second-place finishes. And that was really what started to put this event on the map.
Donna Hoffman, as a presidential scholar, we look a little bit farther on down the line to the presidency of Jimmy Carter and his link to the Iowa caucuses. Is this the first time that the Iowa caucuses really shows its influence?
Yeah, it really does. So Carter could look at the results of 72 and what McGovern had been able to do. And he tried a similar strategy to kind of mount an insurgency campaign, if you will. He wasn't well known in 1976. Of course, we're coming off the heels of Watergate and the country's, you know, kind of in turmoil. It's a strategy that Carter has to run against Washington. He'll go and clean the place up. And part of his strategy, because he had been governor of Georgia, relatively unknown, he comes to Iowa and he, you know, kind of camps out in the state and is able to, in the 76 caucus, actually he gets second. He is seen as winning it, but the first place actually went to uncommitted. And so he is able then to get attention. And it's many weeks then until the New Hampshire primary in 1976. And the media takes notice of him. Stories are written about him. Money comes into him and he gains momentum and is able to carry that through the nomination season to get the nomination.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, earlier today, I spoke with Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg, who has a personal remembrance of that very campaign. He, of course, Dean Borg, longtime host of IPTV's Iowa Press program. Here's his unique memory of the early days of the Iowa caucuses and that Carter breakthrough.
Well, it was on Iowa Press, and on Iowa Press, we usually invite guests and choose. But as is often the case with broadcasters or journalists, they are presented with opportunities, let's put it that way. And we were presented with the opportunity of a governor from the state of Georgia who offered himself, or his handlers did, his campaign managers in Iowa, offered him for an appearance on Iowa Press if we were interested. And we chose to invite Governor Carter on. It was the first time that I'd met him, first time that most Iowans had ever seen Governor Carter. And from that time, though, that program, the appearance on Iowa Press and the interview there, a half-hour program, gave him a sort of legitimacy as he went out and met Iowans in the retail style of politics that the Iowa caucuses espouses. And he used that and his personality to introduce himself and validate himself to Iowans, and the rest is history.
Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg, longtime host of IPTV's Iowa Press program, recalling that interview in the 70s with the governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter, who would become president, and also emphasizing the retail politics nature of this. Let's listen to a political ad from 1976 that touts the grassroots style of the Carter campaign in the months leading up to the Iowa caucuses.
I started my own campaign 21 months ago. I didn't have any political organization, not much money. Nobody knew who I was. We began to go from one living room to another, one labor hall to another, up and down the streets, factory shift lines, barbershops, beauty parlors, restaurants, shaking hands, talking to people, and listening. To special interest groups, I owe nothing. To the people, I owe everything.
Okay, a Jimmy Carter ad from 1976. So Donna Hoffman, there where you see his campaign approach dovetails so perfectly with the nature of the Iowa caucuses, doesn't it?
It does, because caucuses are meetings and they're about organization. And while that organization takes money, there is this aspect of the retail politics where you do go from living room to living room. You go from meeting hall to meeting hall and you meet people and you have to shake their hands and you have to address their questions and talk about the issues they want to talk about. And that really has become a hallmark of what you have to do to be successful in Iowa. Others have tried it sometimes in a little bit different ways, and it hasn't necessarily been all that successful. But there still is this retail component to the Iowa caucuses that is really beneficial, though, for American democracy, too, because caucuses are kind of a throwback to the 18th century, where you have meetings of neighbors, essentially, and you hash things out and you make decisions and you govern yourselves. And that's what caucuses really are.
Ben, Jimmy Carter was so hungry for publicity in that election that he actually did a cooking show on Channel 8, KCCI, in Des Moines with Mary Brubaker. And the folks at TVA still have that clip, and every now and then they rerun it. But there he is at noontime. I think they were cooking fish or something. But
Caroline Talbert, let me turn to you as the co-author of Why Iowa. In looking at the long spans of time that Iowa has come to the fore, starting in the 1970s, how does Iowa now fit into that nominating process as it's developed over the decades?
So Iowa is unique in that it is not only the first major nominating event, but also it uses a caucus rather than a primary. And as we talked about, caucuses are party business meetings where people meet face to face rather than a primary election, which is used in many states where you go to the polls and cast a vote. And it's an anonymous process at the caucuses in Iowa. They share sandwiches. They share soda. You meet your neighbors. And in the Democratic caucus, you actually physically move around the room.
And cajole and get cajoled.
as you choose which candidate you choose to support in the first round of voting. And then as there's a second round of voting, as we kind of consolidate support. So those two features of Iowa are very unique, going first and having a caucus, and it makes it it's much more challenging on the candidates to begin in Iowa than in other states, because with a primary election, you can rely on television ads and mass media coverage. But in Iowa, it really requires organization and getting people out to caucus. It's much more difficult to spend an hour caucusing.
Leaders of campaigns have to figure out sort of a different animal in the caucus. For instance, do the candidates who spend the most time and energy in the state in the run-up to the caucuses generally reap those rewards, or they can come out empty, I suppose, as well?
They can – both of them. We have seen both. We saw John Edwards spent a lot of time in Iowa in 2008, and he did not do as well as he wanted to.
He beat Hillary Clinton, though, by a slim margin.
Right. And Obama, our current president in 2008, had very strong organization in the Iowa caucuses, and that showed. Ron Paul in 2012 had strong organization, and Santorum organization in the state. So starting with Iowa is challenges the candidates, challenges their organization because of this face-to-face politics that we demand. And what's very important is that because this is difficult on the candidates, the campaign organization, and it requires more from Iowa citizens. They have to go to a live caucus. They have to hear presentations about every candidate. They have to really think about which candidate they want to support in a face-to-face type meeting. We often get unexpected outcomes, and Iowa is known for this phenomena of the underdog candidate doing better than expected. And that's what we saw with Carter in 1976. He came in, he was a no-name, and he came in second to undecided, but was declared a winner. We saw this with Obama. Hillary Clinton was the front runner in 2008, and Obama beat expectations, media expectations, did better than expected. We saw this with Santorum in 2012. His candidacy did better than expected in Iowa.
And we'll have to talk about the kerfuffle that happened in 2008 having to do with Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney as well. But to the criticism of this you mentioned too, we have an anonymous person writing an email to us here that I think encapsulates some of the misgivings people might have about this caucus style of nomination. The writer says, "I'm from Alabama where they have primaries. I experienced my first Iowa caucus with the first Obama election. The caucus seemed unorganized, and there was quite a bit of pressure and a sense of being steered like cattle into certain groups where there did not seem to be any real discussion about the candidates or their positions. The goal seemed to be simply get counts of everyone in each group. When it would be clear that the candidate you wanted to vote for did not have enough people, the organizers would tell you which group you needed to join as the candidate has thrown his support there." Donna Hoffman, a valid criticism?
It is. I mean, it can look very chaotic. And certainly in 2000, especially on the Democratic side where you have the realignment, there was massive turnout in terms of what we're talking about here.
And 2008.
In 2008, yes. And in those areas, you oftentimes didn't have enough room. It was very crowded. There were a lot of first-timers who hadn't caucused before. It can appear very chaotic. There are people who organize, you know, in their own precincts, their groups, and then when the realignment may have to take place, there may be strong-arming or discussion or deliberation. But, you know, it is this meeting in which people interact with each other, and it to outsiders or people who haven't seen it before or don't study it, it can look kind of very chaotic and doesn't make a lot of sense. But what the party is doing is governing itself. It's not just the allocation of delegates. It's also electing various party leaderships, talking about party platforms as well. And in 2008, some of those things got pushed to the side because there was such massive turnout in some of the precincts. But again, you had, you know, almost 2,000 precincts in 2008, and each precinct was meeting and dealing with a very large turnout.
Well, and Ben, yeah. Part of that may have looked chaotic to the writer, but in fact, the Obama campaign was so well organized that they determined once they had enough votes to win in a precinct, they would shift surplus voters over to John Edwards because it was important to Obama not just to beat Hillary Clinton, but to see that she finished third. And they were successful in that. I'd never seen anything like that before in a caucus. Usually you just settle for running up your own total. Mm-hmm. But they had so many people that they were able to assure that Edwards finished in second place.
And could be the spoiler for Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
Caroline.
Our survey, our exit poll data from 2008 shows that one-third of caucus attenders on the Republican and the Democratic side were first-timers. So this was a very high turnout caucus in 2008 and a very high percentage of people who had never caucused before. We also asked survey data. In our surveys, we ask, why did you decide to caucus? And obviously to support a candidate, to support a party, because it's the right thing to do. We also asked, was it, you know, enjoyable? And actually a large percentage of Iowans find caucusing fun.
Right.
And so for an election and a civic engagement duty to be fun, that's kind of unique.
That is a tall order. And that's the distinction also with a primary. I'm glad you brought that up, Caroline, because when you're at a caucus, you have a lot of contact with people. A lot of words are exchanged back and forth. It is anything but going to a primary voting booth and checking a box. I want to ask David Yepsen in a moment about his remembrance of the 2008 caucus season. But first, let's listen to a little bit of the victor, the surprise come from behind victor in the 2008 Iowa caucus. A few words from then candidate Obama's Iowa caucus victory speech in January of 2008.
You have done what the cynics said we couldn't do. You have done what the state of New Hampshire can do in 5 days. You have done what America can do in this new year, 2008. In lines that stretched around schools and churches, in small towns and in big cities, you came together as Democrats, Republicans, and independents to stand up and say that we are one nation, we are one people, and our time for change has come.
Barack Obama in 2008, victory speech, winning the Iowa caucuses. David Yepsen, as someone who covered politics for decades here in Iowa and toward the end of your time in Iowa covering that amazing 2008 campaign, what stands out for you?
Well, just the way the events have changed. I mean, I started – my first one was the Carter campaign, the 76 campaign. And, you know, you literally could in those days hop in the backseat of a car with a candidate and have a nice time to chat with them and get out and go to an event, which really was in somebody's living room or kitchen with the local party activists, and then you got in the car again and drove on to the next town. By 2008, you know, this thing had progressed to just where it really is a media circus. It's a changed event. There are literally thousands of media people here, and it's lost to me. It lost some of its charm. Is sort of a victim of its own success. You know, originally the caucuses were seen as a neighborhood meeting. In fact, the word caucus is thought to be an Algonquin term, that's a Native American term for a meeting of tribal leaders, and it very much was that. Now it's much more these massive events. It looks much more like a regular election.
Donna Hoffman, let me ask you, if there had not been an Iowa caucus. Or let's say this way, if President Obama, now President Obama, then candidate Obama, had not won the Iowa caucuses, would he still have had a fair shot at the nomination?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because Hillary Clinton was very much seen as the front runner for much of that campaign, and Obama gave her a run for her money. And she also kind of ran out of money. They didn't actually, her campaign didn't plan for very far after Super Tuesday. The Obama campaign had a really interesting strategy, while the Clinton campaign really kind of focused more on primary states. He focused more on caucus states. And as we've talked about, his superior organization really helped him in that regard. And so that was really key. And Iowa was really key. And, you know, there is a relationship that we see with states that go later in terms of Iowa. And Iowa, in 2008, the calendar was so front-loaded with super-duper Tuesday, basically, in 2008, where there was actually more attention focused on Iowa and New Hampshire, because after those events, and you had Nevada and South Carolina in there as well as the four early states. But then after that, when you got to that first Tuesday in which the other states could go, there were something like 20, 21 states that had events, and it was impossible for those candidates to go to all of those states and give them the attention that the early states got. And so it actually made the early states more important. And so I think, again, this notion of expectations that plays such a huge role in the Iowa caucuses was really important for Obama in Iowa. And the other factor was is that I think the establishment Democratic Party were a little cautious about how well Obama could do in a state that is very undiverse, if you will. Iowa is very white. And so the fact that you had the first African-American presidential candidate that could actually come in and win a caucus in a relatively rural and overwhelmingly white state actually made the party think more seriously about a challenge to Hillary Clinton's, you know, perceived front-runner status.
You know, it's interesting, Obama, there were a lot of African-American voters in other states who had questions about Obama and could he win. And for all the it was interesting, the criticism that had been made of Iowa all the years that it's a lily white state actually worked to Obama's benefit when he won, because it convinced African-American supporters who kind of wanted to be for Obama that they, in fact, could. And that really turned it really moved numbers in the South Carolina primary that followed a short time later.
Caroline Talbert, a quick comment before we go to break. We have about 30 seconds.
Similar, if you can win in Iowa, you can win anywhere. What Obama did by being an underdog candidate and then basically overcoming Clinton and beating media expectations in 2008 was he got what Bush called the big mo, or the big momentum, which is dollars from donors, increased standing in the polls, and frontline media attention in the newspapers.
Caroline Talbert is with us, political science professor at the University of Iowa, co-author of Why Iowa. Donna Hoffman, scholar of presidential politics and department head of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University, formerly of the Des Moines Register. We're talking about the phenomenon known as the Iowa caucuses. Why Iowa and how it's shaped our nation's politics. We want to continue our conversation after a short break. Do you have a personal caucus experience that stands out in your memory? Share it this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook. Back in a moment. It's Iowa Week all this week on Iowa Public Radio's talk shows. The theme this year, Unexpected Iowa, the aspects of our state that are unique and surprising. And if we ask that question, what's something unexpected about Iowa that has become central to our state's identity? The Iowa caucuses makes one of the best answers. So that's what we're talking about this hour with David Yepsen and Caroline Talbert and Donna Hoffman, talking politics, decades of political experience and insights for you this hour, asking you to join in with your questions, 1-866-780-9100. As we recall how the Iowa caucuses started in 1972 and what they've grown into today. Here's a clip from 2008 from Rick Santorum's Iowa caucus victory. And this is an unusual situation, what happened in 2008. Here's his victory speech the night of the caucuses in 2012, rather. I misspoke there. 2012, the closest race in Iowa caucus history, initially reporting that Mitt Romney won by a measure of 8 votes, although later tallies showed Rick Santorum winning by a 34-vote margin. Here's Rick Santorum.
Thank you so much, Iowa. You, by standing up and not compromising, by standing up and being bold and leading with that burden and responsibility you have to be first. You have taken the first step of taking back this country.
Rick Santorum in 2012 declared, not initially but later, the winner of the Iowa caucuses. Let me go to you, Caroline Tolbert. When this deal was done, that Iowa would come first in the nominating process, do you think insiders, people on the political levers across the nation that put Iowa first, knew at all, had any idea what Iowa would come to mean in the nominating process?
I think, as it was discussed earlier in the show, the rules had to be changed and to accommodate the caucuses, from the local caucuses up to the statewide caucus, they had to push the date of the caucuses quite early. And by many accounts, it's an accident that Iowa goes first and that it has such an important influence. That wasn't something that was necessarily a strategic move by the party leaders at that time.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, as a scholar of presidential politics, what if the tally had been correct and Rick Santorum would have been declared the winner right from the start? Would that have made a difference, do you think, considering when we talk about the reverberations that come from the Iowa caucuses?
I actually think the final outcome probably would have been about the same. But, you know, Santorum, because he was deemed the quote-unquote loser by 8 votes, did not benefit from the media attention that he would have gotten had the final vote tally on that night been accurate. And so he does, you know, a couple of weeks later, 10 days later or so, he is, you know, it is determined that he actually won by 34 votes. But, you know, the country had moved on at that point. And Santorum was oftentimes criticized as a candidate who might do well in Iowa, where there's a core of evangelical voters, but that might not do well in other states. So I still think Romney actually would have come out still with the nomination. And 2012 for the Republicans was a pretty interesting year because there were a lot of candidates that were not Romney that the party flirted with during the run-up to the nomination events. And so Santorum, though, did certainly not benefit from that win in terms of it being announced on that night when everyone was focused on the results of the Iowa caucus.
Mm-hmm. In 2012, David Yepsen, that GOP counting kerfuffle there, reported widely. Did that do any long-term damage to the Iowa caucuses?
It may. We'll see. Both parties have always constantly tried to improve their counting systems. And so in one sense, the Republican count on 2012 was the best one that had ever been done. It just wasn't good enough. And we all became much more sensitive to election counts after the 2000 election. And so now there's an expectation by everybody, media, politicians, voters, that counts be fast and that they be accurate. And Republicans have to get it right this time. I think that they've made some adjustments. We'll see. But they're certainly under indictment. And if they don't clean it up and offer some assurances, you may in fact have some candidates who decide that it's not worth the effort. But that said, and the early indications are that the candidates are coming to Iowa. And if they're coming, the media will come, and it still will be important. It's important because it's first.
Mm-hmm. We want to talk about 2016 toward the end of this hour. Donna Hoffman, let me throw this out to you, though. What instances have there been in caucus history when a candidate has chosen to de-emphasize Iowa in their campaign strategy in trying to capture that nomination? And with that, what consequences?
Well, you did have, John McCain in 2000 basically skipped campaigning in the state, and he ended up coming in fifth in that particular year. But yet nationally, it was kind of seen as being a race between him and Bush. And there were reasons in which McCain decided that, you know, he wouldn't devote resources to the state. And part of it had to do with, you know, his stance on ethanol subsidies. But then in 2008, there's a kind of this common misperception that's out there that both McCain and Giuliani, who had for a time was the front runner, that they skipped Iowa. And they actually didn't skip Iowa. Now, both of them did skip the Iowa Republican straw poll in August, but that's a different beast altogether. But if you look at there's an entity at George Washington University that tracks visits to the state of Iowa. And if you look at what those two candidates were doing, Giuliani spent 22 days in the state. McCain spent 43 days in the state in the run-up to the 2008 nomination. And so they actually did campaign. Now, Giuliani really tried to de-emphasize Iowa because, again, he had more liberal social stands that his campaign group didn't think would do all that well in Iowa. He didn't really focus on New Hampshire much either, but did want to focus on Florida. But the problem then in 2008, as I mentioned earlier, was that because that cycle was so front-loaded, that Iowa and New Hampshire actually ended up being more important for later states. And so that strategy for Giuliani didn't work very well at all. And so it is really a careful calculation that a candidate is going to have to make going forward as to whether or not they emphasize Iowa or not, because there is so much attention on the first event that I think it's to the peril of candidates if they decide to forego it.
Caroline Tolbert, you wanted to jump in.
And I just want to follow up. I agree with Donna. Many commentators would argue that you simply cannot skip Iowa anymore. And there was a discussion among the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2008 that she knew she wasn't going to do that well in the state of Iowa. And there was some discussion that she might want to skip Iowa. And I think given the increasing media attention to the Iowa caucuses and the increasing role that that how well the candidates do for generating name recognition and that momentum that comes out of Iowa, that it's very hard to skip Iowa.
You know, the caucuses are now such an institution, have been institutionalized by both parties nationally. In 1984, Iowa and New Hampshire Democrats cut a deal in which Iowa got the first caucus and then New Hampshire had the first primary. A few cycles after that, South Carolina started to emerge as a significant player. And in the Democratic side, they wanted the state of Nevada wanted to have caucuses. And so now in both parties, the way the system has evolved, you have Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. Both of those systems are institutionalized in party rules now. And I don't think many candidates I agree. You know, the bypass Iowa strategy just politically doesn't work. You get left behind.
What if we would have a system where we would have a national primary rather than sequential primaries, David Yaps?
Well, if you love money in politics, you'll love a national primary. I think if you love money in politics, you'll love regional primaries. You know, one of the things that has kept Iowa going has been inertia. There are a lot of people that don't like the Iowa process. And there are critics of it, and I can certainly criticize the process along with everybody else. But what's the alternative? The country has never been able to agree on an alternative. If you just move it to another state, you're going to have the same criticism. It's an atypical state, too much media attention. Who are these people? And so it just doesn't pay dividends. I think it's been institutionalized.
Donna Hoffman, I know you have to leave a little bit earlier than the others to go off to class. I wanted to get your views as we look forward to 2016 and perhaps some lessons learned if you were to advise campaign staffers for 2016. What are we seeing?
Well, you know, we're already seeing visits to the state. And, you know, the first visit that I recorded to the state after the 2012 election actually occurred in late November of 2012 when Marco Rubio came to the state to attend Governor Branstad's birthday celebration. And, you know, then that was followed by a Huckabee visit in February and a Rand Paul and a Scott Walker visit. And, you know, now they're, again, kind of fairly routine. And, you know, we're still more than 2 years out from the general election in 2016. And so it's certainly is shaping up to be, as David mentioned earlier, the candidates are coming back to Iowa. And 2016 will be another election in which there won't be an incumbent running. And both parties will have open nominations. Hillary Clinton, you know, will she run or won't she run, could potentially change the dynamics in terms of how many candidates are in the Democratic primary. But as we saw in 2008, she was the front runner then. She could be, you know, she could not be the front runner going forward as well. And so I think that the 2016 cycle will be very interesting. I think that Iowa will still be very important in the process, and all indications are in terms of scheduling that we're going to maintain our first position. And, you know, the parties, as David also mentioned earlier, you know, have to get it right because the world is watching in terms of what happens in Iowa. And so improvement of caucus procedure has to be looked at by the parties as well.
Donna Hoffman, I think you have to go. Thank you very much for being with us, Department Head and Associate Professor of Political Science at UNI, Scholar of Presidential Politics. Donna, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Talk to you again. Caroline Tolbert, I wanted to explore this with you and David, is how We've seen politics change, campaigning change so much with the advances in technology. What have we seen as far as recent changes that are technologically driven, and what are we likely to see going forward in terms of campaigning for the Iowa caucuses?
So one of the reasons that the Iowa caucuses have become, and we argue in the book Why Iowa, have become more of a media blowout event and more of an agenda-setting event for the New Hampshire primary and for primaries and caucuses nationwide is just the increasing amount of media, both digital and traditional media. And if you look on the day after the Iowa caucuses and do a Google search of just Iowa caucuses, you'll see thousands and thousands of news references to digital media and traditional media. So the increasing volume of the media with the advent of digital media, blogs, Twitter, Facebook, all forms of social media as well as traditional media, is creating more volume and more of a imprint or a footprint of how well these candidates did or didn't do. And I often with my students, I talk about a swimming race and who's the first off the blocks. And often who's the first off the blocks tells you who might win that race. And Iowa is like being – the candidates who do well in Iowa are the ones that get off the blocks fast.
And in fact, David, before you get in here, I wanted to piggyback on that comment because, Caroline, before the show started, you mentioned that your students are doing a research project that has to do with new media, something about the sort of the autocomplete on Google. Explain what you're having your students do.
So here at the University of Iowa, I have 55 students in an undergraduate research design statistics class, and we decided to do a project where we are recording. We have 12 candidates, 3 Democrats and 9 Republicans right now because Clinton's status in the Democratic Party is reducing the number of candidates coming out on the Democratic side. And we are entering their name into a Google keyword search weekly, and we are tracking what keywords are associated with each of the candidate names. These are autocompletes, but what they are is they're forms of framing the candidates for people who want to know about these candidates, and they're using big data. This is Google algorithms of basically how many people have typed in the candidates' names associated with different keywords, and we're already seeing really fascinating trends.
So to be clear about this, you go to the Google page, you go to Google, you type in the one box there, Hillary Clinton or Marco Rubio, and then you see underneath it appear keywords after that name to further be more specific about your search. And so you're looking at the top ones. What are the top ones that appear by these candidates' names? And you'll be tracking those with your class.
Right. And it turns out that Firefox, which is about a third of Americans use Firefox, it provides 8 or 9 keywords. And Chrome, which about 60% of Americans use, provides 4 or 5 keywords. Already, we can see just a hint. Hillary Clinton is the only candidate of the 12 in which the word age was appearing. And Chris Christie was the only candidate of the 12 in which we saw the word scandal or the bridge gate. So we already see some pieces of hints.
David Yepsen, jump in here again.
I think no matter – there's always been technological change in politics. But what strikes me about these events is how at the core it still comes down to the task of motivating and getting your people out to the caucuses on caucus night. You can find different technologies used to organize that and to manage it, but at the end of the day, it's the same. It's getting your people out. You've got to have a candidate who spends time in the state. You've got to have a candidate who has a message that attracts activists, and you've got to have an organization who can dig people out, neighbors out, to turn out. I'm struck, you know, as we talk about these caucuses and the effect on Iowa, it has changed our politics in a couple ways. Number one, it has led to the development of the modern-day Democratic Party in the state. Prior to 1972, it was clearly a Republican state. After that time, you started to see it become more and more Democratic. In 1984, the Democrats had great organizations set up for their caucuses. Republicans didn't because Ronald Reagan was cruising to renomination. And Senator Harkin has told me that he would not be in the U.S. Senate today, having defeated Roger Jepsen, had he not had that cadre of organizers out there who got motivated because of the caucuses. And if you look at the arc of caucuses, many people who are active in Iowa politics today got their start in a caucus. I mean, you have anti-war activists in the Democratic Party. You have religious conservatives in the Republican Party. Many of these people now are leaders of the party, and you're starting to see it repeat itself with the Libertarians' involvement in the Republican Party. And just to put a point on that, I first met Tom Vilsack standing outside Joe Biden's headquarters. He was a volunteer with his wife, Christy, in 1987. And he was getting involved in statewide politics by getting involved in the caucuses. So it has become, it has built a two-party system and has led to a lot of activists who are active in politics today. People are motivated to get involved in politics. And it's really led to the, to a good, healthy two-party competition in Iowa. And trust me, now that I'm spending some time in Illinois, having a healthy two-party competition is better than not having it.
Okay. Before the hour ends, I want to get a caller in. Charles has been waiting on the line from Iowa City. I think, Charles, you have a criticism of the Iowa caucuses you want addressed?
Yes, I would like to have the guest address the question of disenfranchisement. I'm thinking of people who work evening shift jobs who realistically could not get the day off, people in nursing homes, people who are homebound, people who have young children at home and couldn't realistically take them along to the caucuses or afford a babysitter for them. It seems like this process leaves all of those people out.
Right.
I'll take the comments off.
As we've been hearing our news, absentee ballots are rising tremendously, and Charles raises the point that you cannot vote by absentee ballot here. Can you, Caroline?
No, you can register to caucus on caucus day. So we have same day caucus registration, which would be the same as election day registration, but we do not have absentee caucus participation. And because of that, turnout in the caucuses can be lower than in the New Hampshire primary. The argument against it is that that you may not have as representative of a caucus of the caucus participants. In 2008, we found that because turnout was so high in the caucuses, about a third of registered Democrats and a third of registered Republicans caucused in 2008, that actually the caucuses were very representative of the state in terms of ideology across education groups, age groups, income groups. But in a low caucus, in a year with low turnout, you would have more.
In the 2 minutes that we have to remain, I wanted to address one of the dominant themes of politics in this country in recent years and how it fits in with the Iowa caucuses. We always talk about our hyper-partisan environment, which we can trace back to the 1970s. Do the caucuses fit in with that? Do they feed it? Do they work against hyper-partisan politics? Do you think, David Yepsen, and I want to have Caroline also give a crack at this in a moment.
I think that they do. But I think that's, you know, that's not the hyper-partisanship isn't a result of caucuses. It's a result of the gerrymandered redistricting systems that we have in this country combined with an unprecedented amount of money in politics. Mm-hmm. Your caller earlier was right, and one group he didn't mention that was disenfranchised are people serving in the military. And one of the solutions being considered is to have some sort of absentee precinct where people who can't be there can still cast a vote. I think the Democrats are trying to work on that idea. We'll see if it happens.
Carolina, partisanship in the Iowa caucuses.
David, I made the same comment during our break that if you think of the classic election environment that creates a polarized political system, it's gerrymandered districts that have incumbents that are not facing a real competitor and where the incumbent has all the money. And out of those districts, you get here's where you have strong party polarization. I think that Iowa caucuses actually mitigate against this. The grassroots politics forces compromise, more reasonable politics, more participation and engagement by the citizenry. And that's where you have a chance of coming to a moderate compromise.
That's another good thing Iowa has is that they don't have gerrymandering. You have computers that draw legislative districts, and as a result, you have some of the most competitive congressional races in the country in Iowa. It's another thing Iowans probably take for granted, and they shouldn't.
David, very quickly, do you see any realistic scenario where Iowa's first-in-the-nation status would be threatened?
No, I don't. I think you've got to come up with an alternative. You look at the cataclysm that went on that started creating them, the Vietnam War, it would probably take something like that. The nominating processes in the history of the country always evolve. They're always something a little different than the last time. But I think Iowa, as long as Iowans are diligent about having these things operate with some integrity, I think they'll be around for a long time.
David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Caroline Tolbert, political science professor at the University of Iowa. Caroline and David, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Tony Daner helped us out in Cedar Falls. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.